This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is Afternoons on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Helen Farmer with you. Hope you're well. Really interesting deep dive into some of the issues that everyone is talking about right now regarding Dubai property post the weather last week. We were chatting with House and House. How could this impact property prices? And of course, the buying and renting process, the questions you should be asking and when. And it was property lawyer Scott Hutton joining us to unpack liability, what household insurance actually covers, and could you get your deposit back if you have made an offer on an affected area? We were chatting all things skin, aesthetics, tweakments and Botox with Dr. Hassia and speaking to a leading oncologist about the latest treatments and advances in cancer.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer on Dubai Eye 103.8.
With House and House, 10 years of unlocking opportunities in Dubai real estate.
We're talking about what you're talking about, folks. It is all about property this afternoon, and joining us in the studio is Alex Pearson, senior agent in the Arabian Ranches team from House and House. It's been an eventful week, Alex, but the sun is out. How's you?
I'm fantastic, Helen. Thank you so much for having me on. Look, much better today, that's for sure. And there's been a lot better of a buzz around the office as well. So it was an interesting time last week.
I was thinking of a few different industries last week. I mean, we were obviously in the studio every day, you know, teachers on distance learning. And a friend of mine reached out who's in property and she was like, I've got to get into Arabian Ranches for a viewing. What are the roads like? And people were, you know, like, oh, this is fine, that's fine. But it was so hyper-local. I was thinking, what if you do need to get out there and, you know, see somebody, meet somebody, show it? So you were in my thoughts, you guys, last week. Now, there's so much discussion. And as I said, we're going to be covering a lot of the legal side after 4 o'clock today. But I guess I wanted to kind of get the agent's take on the impact of that unstable weather last week. You know, we don't know the full impact yet on a lot of the buildings. It's still ongoing. But I wondered if you could kind of put your hat on and talk maybe a little bit about the impact it could have on decision making when it comes to buying, selling, investing. What are some of the chats in the House and House office been like?
Yeah, well, I think, as you say, it is relatively early stages at the moment. So we're just scratching the surface in terms of, you know, conversations with buyers, with sellers, excuse me, but we are hearing from the buyers, you know, there are some level of concern, but not a huge degree to the point where it's putting them off a purchase completely. Mm-hmm. It's more just those questions, you know, has this area been impacted? Are there any issues? Will there be potential long-term issues? Which I think is a completely fair question.
Completely. It's just doing your due diligence. And it's just, this has obviously heightened some of the questions and, you know, in certain areas of that conveyancing and those, you know, fact-checking, I suppose.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, now it's going to become a part of buyer's criteria, not just, you know, telling us about which particular areas in which they're looking to purchase. It'll be, you know, once again, is this area prone to flooding, or has there been any issues previously? And then start to narrow down the search based off, you know, questions like this.
So do you think it could then impact value? And I'm not going to name, you know, particular developments, but if there are streets that were particularly impacted, could, you know, that be commanding a lesser ticket price?
Yeah, look, and I think it's a tough question, because if you're a seller in the current market and your home has been impacted, then obviously the recommendation would be to rectify the damage. And then really there isn't any excuse as such from a buyer's point of view then. Whereas if you're selling your home now and there is damage, then of course they're going to have to be expecting a slightly lower amount, potentially below the market value. But I think when we're talking market-wide, I think it's really hard to see this playing a massive negative role on where the market's headed. Because although it's been catastrophic for many people, if you look at on a percentage basis, the amount of homes that have been damaged, I think when you're looking market wide, it's not a huge, huge percentage.
I think it's a really interesting opportunity for developers. You know, you do a lot of work off plan at House and House for developers to be thinking, all right, you know, how can we be proactive? How can we set ourselves apart from other developers in the market and say, you know, because let's be brutally honest, this isn't going to be the last period of unstable weather, you know, here in Dubai or globally. It's not. It's going to be part of the conversation. I sincerely hope nothing to the extent that we saw last week. But you know, it's not a case of, you know, flinging up a, you know, a villa or a townhouse here or there or an apartment. It's, I think that a lot of it's going to be, these are the measures we're putting in place. These are the assessments we have done on this plot of land. And this is how we're ensuring that you're going to get a really high quality product for your money. So to the developers out there, I'd love to hear what you're doing. Joining us from House and House in the studio this afternoon, we've got Alex Pearson. He is a senior agent in the Arabian Ranches team.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer on Dubai Eye 103.8.
With House and House, 10 years of unlocking opportunities in Dubai real estate.
Joining us in studio from House and House, we've got Alex Pearson, senior agent from the Arabian Ranches team. We are, of course, talking about property and the unfolding of the last event. So I wanted to ask you, from a proactive point of view, if you are looking to buy or indeed rent a property, in light of the unstable weather last week, what are some of the questions you should be asking an agent, asking an owner, a landlord, to really safeguard you, your family and your rugs?
Yeah, I think first and foremost, it comes down to the initial inquiry, which generally is made through one of the online portals, is to, you know, get on the phone with the broker straight away and ask the question off the bat. There's no harm in having that direct conversation and just saying, look, have there been any impacts to this particular home with the recent weather? If you're then told no, great, obviously go on and complete a viewing yourself. But there are also things you can look out for, like obviously dampness. You can smell it quite often as well. Mm-hmm. So I would just recommend making sure that when you do go to a villa, to an apartment to view, just take as much time as you need, have a good look around, and just make sure that although you've been given the tick of approval from whichever broker you're dealing with, you know, do your own due diligence as well on top of that.
Is there an option during that buying process to have someone independent come in and, I don't know, maybe use a damp meter, if such a thing exists, to find out what's happening?
A damp meter, I do like that one.
You never know.
You can have people come through, I mean, but we are still in a seller's market. So I think we have to remember that. And obviously, you know, quite often if a home is on the market for sale and it's well priced, it's going to be snapped up quite quickly. Mm-hmm. So if you go to a seller with two different buyers, one of them is willing to offer straight away without any additional clauses to a contract or any additional people coming through to check the home versus someone who's bringing everybody through, you know which way a seller's going to go. It does sound quite blunt, but that's generally the way a seller would think in this market.
I just find it really interesting over the last few days, the perception of certain developments and developers in Dubai, because I saw a friend at the weekend and they were talking, they've recently bought, and I was like, oh, you know, how's your place? And he was like, it's actually fine, but around our area hasn't been, but no one's talking about this neighbourhood. There's been a lot of focus on some particular ones. So it's going to be really interesting to think about the impact of perception, I guess, over the coming months and years. And we've got no idea what that's going to look like. But I'd be very interested for us to have a catch up in a few months and say, do you know what, there has been a dip in light of the weather.
Definitely. And also, I think that some really positive signs are coming off the back of this and giving people a lot of confidence when it comes to buying in a particular area, because a lot of these master developers in particular are now coming forward rather than just burying their heads in the sand, acting like this never happened. They're coming forward and they're finding ways to find a resolution around what's happened. You know, some have put people up in accommodation, for example. Some have said, you know, we're going to rectify the damages caused up to a certain amount or whatever it may be. So it is a very proactive approach that they're taking.
And we have, as we said, over the weekend as well, seen a huge promise of influx of spending and investment in this in Dubai, and a huge amount of thanks as well and recognition. So thank you from us, all at Dubai Eye 103.8, for all of the hard work that has been done. And thank you, Alex Pearson, for your time today. Really appreciate the insights. As I said, it's going to be one that I think it's going to be an evolving conversation. It really, really is. But I'm glad you're safe, you're well. You know, your clients are able to get out and about and do some viewings. And please, 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 if you've got any questions relating to property, you can direct them to House and House. You can send me the word house if you want, and I'm happy to send you Alex's details. And we are talking Law After Four. Stay well, stay safe.
Thank you so much. Cheers, Helen. Thank you.
Speak to you soon. Joining us in studio now, Scott Hutton. He is a partner and the head of construction practice at BLK Partners. It is your property law clinic. Do you need a little sit down and a biscuit, Scott? How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you, Helen. I'm delighted to have got out of the house today and got on the roads and got here safely.
Hey, listen, the kids are back at school. It's a new dawn. It's a new day. It's take two.
Oh, yeah, we had a week or a day last week, right?
One day.
Boom.
What are some of the most common questions that are coming into your email inbox that people are messaging about with with property law and the unstable weather over the last week, Scott?
Yeah, well, I think the principal thing is, help, what do I do? I'm underwater, or my car's underwater, or who's liable? And I suspect pretty much everything we'll deal with today, I'm expecting this to be a busy one. And I presume most of it will be around repairs. Mm-hmm. Right? Liability, what's happened, who's responsible?
Maybe we can head off some of those conversations immediately and help as many people as possible by talking about liability. What does that word even mean? And when we're talking about, let's create a scenario. Let's say you're a renter, you moved into a property, you've got a good relationship with your landlord or landlady, which I always think sounds like a drinking establishment rather than a property exchange.
And it says more about you, Helen, than anything else.
It's quite possible. Yeah. And it's been a tough week. There has been damage to your own property in terms of, you know, rugs, furniture. There's been damage to things like, you know, kitchen units and flooring. What do we need to know, or what do we need to look at in our contracts to understand who or what is going to be footing the bill?
Sure. First thing to look at is your lease, right? So we're talking about tenancy situations. So look at the lease. What does it provide for? More often than not, a residential lease will be silent on it, won't say anything, in which case it's a landlord's responsibility. Now, it's a landlord's responsibility to maintain the property in the same condition, right? So that means he's liable for the property, for any damages to it. If it's a furnished apartment, then he's responsible for the furniture as well. But again, the majority of the time, it won't be. So unfurnished apartment, villa, you're responsible for the contents, and landlord's responsible for the building and everything provided with it.
Interesting. We had a message from Seb saying, our place was thankfully fine, but it got me thinking. It's surprising how many people assume it's a landlord's responsibility to cover furniture damage, etc. So in terms of, let's go back in time. What insurance should we all have, Scott? Yeah.
So last Monday, everyone should have been getting contents insurance, or every tenant. Look, contents insurance is one of these things that, you know, don't want to go into the specifics of insurance because I'm not an insurance expert, but like everyone else, I've had my battles with insurers. And contents insurance, you just got to understand what it is and what you get out of it. You, as a tenant, you are responsible for your own contents, everything within you, everything in your house. And that often includes, for example, jewellery when outside the house. So there's a good plus to a contents insurance policy. Mm-hmm. But this scenario where, you know, we've all seen pictures of the houses with their furniture floating around the living room. They probably have to be replaced. Insurance, if you have contents insurance, should cover that. It's exactly what it's for. But I'd be interested to look at stats on that. And I suspect less than half of the population tenanting or tenants have contents insurance.
I think that's probably optimistic. To be truthful. Scott, what about things like if you are renting a villa or an apartment, it becomes completely uninhabitable as a result of that weather? Whose responsibility is it to pay for accommodation, to look at, you know, long-term or, you know, or short-term solutions until your home is ready to live in again?
Okay, well, by the same principle, landlord is responsible for that property and making sure it's available for occupation and use, right? It's for you to call it peaceable possession or quiet possession. So if it's not fit for purpose, then the landlord is responsible for damages. So losses you incur. So for example, if you have to move out and be in a hotel for a couple of days or a week or whatever, then technically those damages should be claimable from the landlord. Now, unless you have a very good relationship with your landlord, it's unlikely they're going to front up with that option. And you may end up again in the RDC, the Rent Dispute Centre, but technically you should be able to claim them. But it's not for you or me to say this is uninhabitable. Mm-hmm. We need an expert to determine that. And the expert's not going to turn up right now when you're underwater, right? And you've got to make a call on it. So it's not easy. What I would say to people is anyone in that situation, if you've got damaged property, get your photos taken immediately, because you're going to have to show the state things were in, the amount of water that was in there, the damage that was done. And, you know, after a couple of weeks, everything dries out. Does the damage look the same? You've got to be able to to prove that damage. And like I say, the expert's not turning up and like he's not waiting for your back call, you know?
No, not popping over in their wellies anytime soon. All right, Scott Hutton, we've had a message here saying, how can we build a house in Dubai? In which areas can we build and sell? Sam asking, what sort of proof does a landlord have to provide when they evict due to selling? And we're hearing from one listener who's put an offer on one of the worst affected parts of town. Would she lose her deposit if she backs out now? We're unpacking that next.
Dubai Eye 103.8 presents an array of independent expert opinions and does not advise one particular view. Always seek independent legal advice which considers your own personal circumstances.
Scott Hutton is in the studio, partner and head of construction practice at BLK Partners. We are, of course, talking about the impact on property, what you're liable for, what your landlord might be liable for, should you be affected. Text lines are open, phone lines are open. We'd love to help. Have a little listen to this. This is from Katie, who's got a question about buying at this time.
My question is regarding the fact that I'm currently buying a villa in Arabella in Moudon, which is one of the most affected areas in Dubai following the storm. I haven't transferred yet, and luckily the house hasn't been affected, but I wanted to know what my options would be had the villa been seriously affected and damaged, and whether I was able to withdraw from the purchase, therefore breaking the Form F, and would I lose my deposit, which is obviously a substantial amount.
All right, Scott Hutton, what comes to mind? Because I'm sure there's a lot of people right now going, is it time to bag a bargain or am I too long down this road to get out?
Well, it's interesting. Did you say Sophie?
Katie.
That she mentions that this property was not damaged. So it's hypothetical, I guess. If the property is not damaged, on what basis are you getting out? You know, there has to be a substantial change. Now, could you say, for example, that the development is shown to have issues in the master community? To be honest, I don't think that'll get you far. I think if your property is directly affected, then, yeah, because risk hasn't transferred, right? Risk transfers on the date of transfer. Mm. So if we sign a contract, I'm selling, you're buying, I'm responsible for that until the day you take it. So if it's badly damaged, that's on me before the signing.
That's interesting as well, because as you say, her potential property hasn't been damaged. I guess it's a perception thing, it's a reputational thing, and it's a what if, which is completely unmeasurable and therefore probably very hard to hold up.
Yeah, and you're then into the specifics of if you could claim damages, it's on actual losses. How do you quantify that? Mm-hmm. Can you definitively state that the development value has changed? I doubt it.
It's going to be an interesting conversation, though, over the coming weeks and months. It really is.
And what about, for example, where this level of rain affects substructures?
Well, I want to talk to you about how property developers, because I know this is your background, perhaps could and should be approaching building in the future. We've just been talking about household insurance, and Mark works in community management, 12 years in Dubai. Mark, you've got some insights on this. What do we need to know? What are the numbers?
Buy some insurance. That's what you need to know.
Oh, a wise man, Mark, but it sounds like an awful lot of people don't have it.
It's something that we regularly try to advise people of when they're moving into communities, that home contents insurance is frankly pretty cheap in this part of the world. Mm-hmm. Thankfully, the insurers don't have to consider the prospect of theft in many, many cases, which unfortunately can be a blight in Europe or Western or other parts of the world. So as a consequence, the premiums here for home contents aren't particularly high. And in many cases, they will protect against, water egress into the apartment. Oftentimes, they may even have some assured to give you alternative accommodation if you have to move out of the property, et cetera, et cetera. So my understanding after dealing with brokers and insurance companies for years is that the take-up is appallingly low and way under 10%.
Way under 10%. Can I ask, when you were talking about working in community management, which parts of town have you been working with, Mark?
Dubai Marina, JLT, Business Bay, Arjan, JVC, also up into Sharjah and Ras Al Khaimah as well.
And how did you fare in this last week? Is everything okay?
Well, we've got about 117 properties across our Dubai portfolio, and thankfully most of them are okay. A handful where no power and no water. Mm-hmm. Because of flooded basements, and that's where a lot of the machinery is. So that's a real tough one to deal with. And it takes, I mean, just literally hundreds of journeys from water tankers to pump out those basements and get stuff working again.
It's going to be a long process, but as you rightly say, no, we need to be proactive as individuals as well. Mark, thank you for your insights. Really, really appreciate it. Mark saying there around approximately 5% of the market is home contents insurance. Guys, the time is now. Scott Tashin with us today. The text lines are busy. It is your free legal clinic, and we are, of course, talking property.
Dubai Eye 103.8 presents an array of independent expert opinions and does not advise one particular view. Always seek independent legal advice which considers your own personal circumstances.
Scott Hutton is in the studio. He is partner, head of construction practice at BLK Partners. Very busy man, as you can imagine, over the course of the last week. And we're still on the way to answer my questions, but most importantly, yours. Now, your background is, as I said, construction real estate. What kind of advice do you think you would be giving to developers about considering the UAE weather more when building new properties in the future, Scott?
Well, you could extend that well outside the UAE, couldn't you?
Absolutely.
The world is changing.
Climate change, a go-go.
Yep.
The world is angry at us.
I was talking to someone this morning about reclamation and reclaimed land. Now, you factor into that, is the sea level going to rise by a metre? How long is it reclaimed for? Yep. But look, I would give the same advice I've always given. I always think you should be doing a survey. And it's very common here, not in my experience anyway, for developers not to do land surveys, because we know what we're getting. More or less. But my job is to make sure there is no more or less. We're 100%. So I would always say you want to do a land survey. I think, given what we've seen in the last week, that becomes far more important. What effect has this flooding had on the subsoils? I would say it's worth investigating.
What about even design features on buildings as well? It's going to be really interesting to think about how developers, put themselves ahead of the competition over the coming months and years.
But rain is nothing new. Globally, it's something I'm Scottish, so we're pretty well used to this.
Well, we were talking about driving in the rain last week with Damien, and I was like, I can talk to you about this. No bother at all. Right, to the text line we go. We're going to help out as many people as possible. No name on this one saying, how can we build a house in the UAE? Which areas can we build on and sell? Interesting question. Yep. Individual plots of land for people to own, occupy themselves?
It depends on where you're from, effectively, right? So GCC nationals can buy anywhere in Dubai, and there's lots of plots available for sale. And you build your own property there, subject to planning rules under the Dubai municipality. For non-GCC nationals, you're then looking at the freehold designated areas, which are the areas we know about, right? And a lot of these developments are areas where you can buy. There's already a master community, so you're then restricted as to what you can build, and it's generally one of a few options, right? But if you can find a plot available, and you look at the PAM, for example, you drive down the front, you see drastically different buildings. You can build your own design there within reason. Dubai Hills, you see a lot as well. There's no straight answer there, because it depends
so
on
where you're from, what you're doing. A message here saying, can the landlord increase the rent for the period between the last day of the contract and the day you have to vacate after eviction note? Let's say contract ends in May, but you can stay in the house until December. Could he increase the rent for that period? Thank you.
Well, the RDC, the Rent Dispute Centre, and me are slightly in disagreement on this one. So I say, yes, the landlord can increase for that period. But I've said that to an RDC judge who told me otherwise, give me a judgment otherwise. But bearing in mind that there's no precedent in the local court, so the judgment says X, the next judgment might say Y. So personally, there's nothing in the law to stop a landlord increasing the rent for the period from expiry of the lease to the expiry of the 12-month notice period.
But both parties need to be obviously on board and signed and agreed. It can't be a case of, and here's your final bill.
Right, correct. Yeah.
Okay. A message here saying, I'm renting an apartment on the Palm for over a year now. There are maintenance issues, i.e. bathroom basin not working at all. It looks like the landlord has no intention of fixing it and I'm paying a premium rent. What can I do if this maintenance issue keeps getting ignored? Thank you.
That's one of these things that a lawyer says, well, you go to court, you go to the RDC.
And I go, oh, Scott, I'm never going to do that.
Yeah. So the only option then is to take the matter into your own hands. I would say go and do the work, record everything, keep a clear record of what you've done, you know, photographs before and after, clear invoices, statements from your builders as to what you've done. Then you can go and claim that after the fact.
If this listener didn't want to go down the court route, how straightforward is that and how expensive is that?
The RDC route, the Rent Dispute Centre, is pretty efficient and pretty straightforward. So the fees there are 3.5% of the claim value, I think. Now, it's certainly okay. 3.5%. So it's relatively affordable relative to court, is 6%. Dubai, so considerably cheaper. It is an online system, so you do everything online. You can do it yourself. You don't need lawyers. You can do it in the English language as well. So have a look at the RDC website. It's worth a shot.
Okay. Scott Tutton is with us today. When we come back, we're going to be answering questions that have come in, including, I've signed a rental contract for a two-bed apartment due to move in soon, but the basement parking is underwater. Lots of damage to communal areas. Can I renegotiate lower rents in light of that? We've also had a message asking about what sort of proof does the landlord need to provide when they are evicting due to, quote-unquote, selling. Sam, we're going to come to that. I also had just a message coming in. So we have a leasehold property in the Villa community. Is there a defined process of converting that into a freehold ownership? Let's see what Scott Hutton has to say.
Dubai I 103.8 presents an array of independent expert opinions and does not advise one particular view. Always seek independent legal advice which considers your own personal circumstances.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer on Dubai I 103.8.
With King's College Hospital London in Dubai, bringing the best of British healthcare to the UAE.
Helen Farmer with you just for a few more minutes. We're going to try and get through as many questions as possible, as in the hot seat is property lawyer Scott Hutton. The text line we go, Kay saying, I recently signed a rental contract for a two-bedroom apartment due to move in beginning of May. However, the basement parking is underwater, lots of damage to communal areas. Can I renegotiate a lower rent in light of this? What say you? What say the law, Scott?
Fact is, you've signed a contract, right? So you're bound by that contract. And if the property is available on the date of handover, I would say you're stuck with it. But then again, it's an open market, right? You can always try.
What do we say in the northeast in Scotland? Shy burns getting out.
That's it.
Which is translated to, if you don't ask, you don't get.
Okay.
Yep. Jay say, a friend of mine's apartment was damaged very badly due to the apartment above them. No other apartment was damaged. She's waiting to hear back from insurance, but also legally, what can she do? Who would be responsible? I'm afraid it could take a long time. Mould has already started to grow on the floor and the walls and needs to be fixed as soon as possible because they've got a small baby and insurance is going to take a long time. I wonder what would happen if the damage was actually done by the apartment above and not the rain, in the way it's been viewed. Who's liable for damages and accommodation? Who should pay?
Ultimately, in that scenario, if there's a problem in the apartment up above that causes an issue for you, then that apartment, the upstairs apartment, the owner there is responsible, right? Again, that doesn't get it fixed immediately. So that's what I think. You've got to take matters into your own hands, particularly if there's a baby, you know, mould. Get it dealt with, but record it. Mm-hmm. Keep details of everything you do. And then ultimately you can claim that, whether it's through your insurance or the insurance of the owner above you. Because their contents insurance or their building insurance, depending on where the defect is, right? We don't know. So someone needs to establish what the problem is. And then is it a developer issue? Is it the owner issue? Is it an insurance issue?
Okay. I really hope that helps. All the very best. Andy asking on the text line, we own a leasehold property in the Villa community. Is there a defined process for converting that into a freehold ownership? Thank you.
Honest answer, Andy, is I don't know. But I would be surprised if there's not, because most of the leasehold areas that I'm aware of have a process of conversion in place. Mm-hmm. And the authority, you go to the developer or the authority, they should have a system in place for it.
Last question to you, Scott Hutton. It's one we've touched on the show before, but I think, always think it's a really, really good reminder. Sam is asking, what sort of proof does a landlord have to provide when they are evicting due to, quote unquote, selling?
Really good question. And again, I can't give you a definitive answer, but I've had cases where landlords are not producing any sort of evidence. And the way the law is written to me, the way I believe it should apply, is that the landlord has to make genuine efforts to sell. I had a scenario where a client made an offer to buy. So a tenant, they were tenanting the property, got the eviction notice, said, okay, well, I'd be interested in buying this. The landlord didn't engage at all. And then the property was advertised for rent before the lease was even over, you know. So like we've discussed in the past, if I don't like playing the system, but if you are going to play the system, at least be sensible and smart with it.
Mm-hmm.
I think if a landlord genuinely approaches an agent, you'll have to show a contract with an agent and that he's receptive to reasonable offers. You can't, a million dirham apartment, you can't put on the market for 20 million and expect that to be taken seriously.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a reasonable, my view, it's a reasonable effort to sell.
Scott Hutton, thank you so, so much. As I said, I know how busy you are right now for very obvious reasons. Property lawyer, construction partner at BLK, thank you so much. Wishing you a non-soggy week ahead and a speedy drive home.
You're welcome.
Is that all we can wish for everyone in Dubai right now? I think it really is. But stay safe. And if you want Scott's details, you can send me the word law to 4001.
Dubai Eye 103.8 presents an array of independent expert opinions and does not advise one particular view. Always seek independent legal advice which considers your own personal circumstances.
You know, we've got a good guest when both Chloe and I are asking off air for advice. We're talking skin between now and three. Dr. Hassia is with us today. She's the CEO and founder of Doctors Do. She's a UK and American board certified. And she's here in Dubai just 6 months ago at Vawati Clinic around Al Wasl area in right here in Dubai. Welcome to the show and welcome to Dubai. How are you, Doctor?
Thank you so much for having me on. I'm well, thank you. How are you, Helen?
I'm very well. I'm very well. I'm very interested in some of the things that you've been talking about on your social media recently.
Yeah. Yes.
You did a video on basically dodgy aesthetics.
Oh, yes.
And I wondered if you could maybe shed some light on some of the things that you're seeing, hearing, and maybe some of the consequences of when it's not an expert wielding the needle.
Yes.
So what's going on? What have you been hearing?
You know, so I, as you said, I came around 6 months ago now. So one of the things that I've noticed is that there's a lot of unlicensed people coming over from all sorts of countries and doing basically botch up jobs in hotel rooms or wherever you have it, you know. So a lot of these I see, they're coming from Russia or the UK. And it's because in these countries, aesthetics is not that regulated.
So they're getting effectively the equipment, the medicine, the Botox, the injectables, the fillers, bring them here and then...
In suitcases.
Wow.
Yeah, in suitcases, the Botox, the fillers, and, you know, they're unlicensed. They are therefore, of course, unsafe. They're doing it in unhygienic conditions. And then as a result, there's so many people that are walking around with, you know, bad jobs, overfilled, lumpy filler. And, you know, more importantly, there's people that are getting, you know, serious complications from this.
This is what I wanted to ask you, because yes, there's the aesthetic side of, we've already had a question, by the way, about fillers migrating. So that's one for you. I had questions about some acne as well. But you can do damage to nerves. You can, you know, you, it's not just a temporary droopy eye potentially. Things can go actually really badly wrong when aesthetics are done poorly by someone who's not qualified. Have you had people come to you saying, I need you to fix my face?
Absolutely. You know, I've only been here a short time, but even in that time, you know, with the content that I'm putting out, people are watching it and they're thinking, yes, you know, I have suffered from that. I need to come and see you. So there's so many people. And you have to think about aesthetics, like it's medical. It's regulated for a reason.
It's needles.
It's needles in the face. And yes. If you think about the face, look at the muscles, the tendons, the nerves, the blood vessels. It's not you just sticking a needle in at someone's cheek or in someone's lip. It's more complicated than that. Mm-hmm. And as a doctor, you know, I've been a doctor now for almost 10 years. And I did training for 5 years. It was 5 years in medical school. And we have very in-depth anatomy sessions on cadavers, you know, on actual people who, when they passed away, they gave the, you know, permission to use their bodies for science. So we, you know, we go through every nerve, every blood vessel, every muscle, we peel back these layers and we do really in-depth education. And for someone just to come and start sticking needles in the face, it's completely, it's ridiculous.
This is not the time to cut corners, folks. That's really what we're saying. It's not about you know, getting a good deal or getting a referral from someone on a Facebook group. It's so much more than that.
Absolutely.
Something caught my eye in the UK press recently that I wanted to put to you, which was the British College of Aesthetic Medicine saying the number of men opting for injections to make them look younger, more handsome has increased. Mm-hmm. Wait for it. 70% in the last 2 years. Male customers now taking up around a fifth of appointments. Between the UK and, of course, here in the last 6 months, what have you noticed in terms of an uptick in male clientele?
It's more in Dubai.
Is it?
Yes.
Interesting. Okay.
Much more in Dubai, definitely.
What are the menfolk asking for?
Botox, skin boosters, the, you know, collagen stimulators. I mean, if you think about it, in Dubai, it's a desert weather, desert climate. Doesn't matter how many concrete buildings you have here, but it is desert climate. So you've got the desert sun, you've got all of this going on. And people, whether you like it or not, you're going to see this super fast aging. And that's why men, even if they don't want the fillers, they're going to come in for their skin. They want to look younger.
Gentlemen, the text lines are open. Dr. Hassia is with us today. She's the CEO and founder of Doctors Dose, American and US board certified. And here at Vuati Clinic, we've had questions, as I said, about acne. We've had questions about fillers migrating. We've also had asked about hair loss. Up next, what do we need to know about the screens in our life? We've been talking about the climate, about aging our skin. That blue light might be doing more than just disrupting your sleep. That's next.
This content is for informational purposes only and does not intend to substitute professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
I always find it really interesting which health shows in particular really resonate with you listening today. And I can tell you which ones are really popular. Whenever we talk teeth, we get lots of messages. Whenever we talk feet, it's very popular. And skin, of course, always, always needs a bit of helping hand. And joining us this afternoon until 3 o'clock to take my questions, but most importantly yours, is Dr. Hassia. She is a UK and American board certified. We're also CEO and founder. And she is at Vuati Clinic now in Dubai. Let's talk, and I'm nervous to ask you this, about some of the factors that are speeding up the aging of our skin. I am in a studio with bright lights. I've got three screens in front of me. Like most people, my phone is within arm's distance of me at all times. And most of the things we're hearing from experts is the disruption of our circadian rhythms, that, you know, that blue light can be really, really problematic for our patterns of sleep. But you're saying our skin might be another victim?
Absolutely. I mean, so when you talk about the sleep, first of all, if you've got lack of sleep, you're not getting enough sleep and rest, that directly also impacts your skin. You look tired in the face, your under eyes, you know, your aging process, it speeds up. So you've got that side of things as well. But the blue light itself damages some of the cells in your skin. So it disrupts the DNA in the melanocytes, in particular in the skin. So your phone, your laptop, computer, things like this, it all does that. And this has been proven in many studies.
So, oh, man. Yeah.
So
we're doomed.
It speeds up aging. It causes hyperpigmentation. It can worsen melasma. It can cause dark spots, tired, dark under eyes, all of that.
I can see Milani in the booth. Her eyes are just wide like a saucer going, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Okay, on the counter side, what can we do to stop that, prevent that, minimize that?
Go back to using a Nokia 3310.
Really?
So, I mean,
bit of snake, bit of kick.
Yeah, basically. So, I mean, look, the super easy thing to do is reduce your screen time. If you can't reduce your screen time like yourself, just take regular breaks away from the screen. You can use SPF, but when we talk about SPF, it has to be an SPF that contains titanium oxide, because it's the titanium oxide which actually helps against the UV damage from blue light.
So is that like a barrier as such?
Or? Yes. Okay. It's like a physical barrier that the titanium oxide forms.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think during a bit of Lady Antebellum in a few minutes, I'm going to be Googling my sunscreen and seeing if it gets the Dr. Hassier seal of approval. Now, I wanted to ask you about anti-aging, because it is a really hot topic. And we, as I said, we have had messages about aesthetics, which we're going to come to. But from the skincare point of view, we see so much in the press about, you know, retinol, retinoids, tretinoin, and building skin tolerance to that, using it for acne, using it for anti-aging. What do we need to know about some of these very, very active ingredients and incorporating them? And I guess using them under supervision a lot of the time.
So retinols, you know, retinals, retinoic acid like tretinoin, they all come under the umbrella of retinoid. Retinoids are the most effective skincare active ingredient, most effective. And it starts from retinol, which if you're a beginner, that's where you should start. It's over the counter. Then you go up to retinal, and that's things like adapalene. And then you go up to your super heavy stuff, like the tretinoin, the tazarotene. And these are, they should only be used under the supervision of a doctor, although we know that they can sometimes be found over the counter in some places. But if you're in somewhere like Dubai, I always say this, you've got the sun as it is, and you're using tretinoin without supervision at whatever strength you're using it at, it can do more harm than good. It can cause a lot of peeling on the skin, trauma to the skin, inflammation on the skin. And all of these things that are prolonged can cause aging, hyperpigmentation, and worsening of your skin. So absolutely, if you want to see the best effects of these, do it under the supervision of a doctor.
Dr. Hassier with us today. Doctor, not Dr. Google. She's in the studio through until three. We are going to go to the text line next. If you do have any questions, you're more than welcome to reach out. In the meantime, though, if people want to check out your Instagram during a bit of a song, what's the best way of finding you online?
It's at Dr. Hassier, D-O-C-T-O-R, Hassier, H-A-S-I-A.
Some really, really fascinating insights there. Some very, very popular videos. So have a little nosy of that. With Talking Skin all the way through until three.
This content is for informational purposes only and does not intend to substitute professional medical advice, diagnosis or treatment.
We have had questions about fillers. We've had questions about adult acne, about best under eye treatments and more. There really is no such thing as a silly question. Just a great chance to get an opinion and a second opinion. Oh, KJ, turkey neck, is surgery my only option? I feel like I need to know the answer too. That's coming up. In studio, a very, very, very busy and popular guest. We've got Dr. Hassier with us today. She is UK and American board certified, CEO and founder of Doctor's Dose. We're talking skincare, aesthetics, tweakments and more. And something in the headlines recently is Ozempic face. I wondered if you could explain a little bit about what this is and if you're seeing it in clinic. Go on.
So Ozempic face, Mounjaro face, Wegovy face, essentially you have lost a lot of weight very quickly and you get this volume loss in your cheek area and it makes you look really gaunt and, you know, it ages you. And it can also give you some sagging and the jowling can get worse as well. And a really good example of this is Sharon Osbourne. and Kelly Osborne, and they've been very open about being on Ozempic and using it. So they're really good examples.
So then you must get into this kind of, you know, cycle of losing weight, but then putting fillers in your face, and yes, your face is, and then it just goes on and on and on.
Absolutely. Then you want to restore that volume, because now you've aged like 10, 20 years. So we put the fillers back in. You can do skin boosters. You can do PRP plasma gel. You can do collagen stimulators like Sculptra. There's so many options to do that.
I'm just hearing like ka-ching, ka-ching, ka-ching. You're spending yep. for the drug. I mean, you're saving on the food. I guess.
You're saving on the food.
But then you're spending on the treatments. Right, Dr. Hassia, we've got a lot of questions to get through. So to the text line we go, 40001 if you want to talk aesthetics, treatments and skincare as well. A message here saying, please, can you ask your lovely doctor about hormonal acne in your 40s? I'm 44 years old. I've never had spots before, but they're breaking out on my cheeks near my nose. Really angry, inflamed skin. Please help. I'm feeling horrid.
Oh,
let's talk acne. What can we do?
Okay, so hormonal acne, you know, this affects so many women. On I think in the general population, acne affects over 95% of the population. So hormonal acne affects so many women. And first of all, you need a proper diagnosis. Is this hormonal acne? It's usually the clinical picture that we go with, along with your history, your menstrual cycle and things. So we don't need to do hormone testing usually. It doesn't really involve a blood test. But also you mentioned it's around your nose and cheeks. Now, is it hormonal acne or is it something like perioral dermatitis? So diagnosis is super important first, and then you go into the management. Now, you're 44 years old. It's not uncommon to see at that age. You can also see it in the perimenopausal years, postmenopausal years as well, because your hormones are fluctuating. So the treatment, you need something with spironolactone. The best combination is spironolactone with tretinoin. That's a topical cream. I'm very much a topical cream person, because I feel like if you take oral spironolactone or oral Accutane, there's so many side effects you can suffer from. And if we can avoid it, we should avoid it.
I will send you Dr. Hassia's details, mystery listener. That is not a problem, because you have obviously your own range as
yes.
well. But the most important thing, as you say, because hormonal acne is often around kind of the chin and the jaw, and mm-hmm. it sounds like it's somewhere else. So don't be going out and buying over-the-counter things and whacking on, expecting yeah. the acne to disappear. You need to understand exactly what you're dealing with.
Absolutely.
Marianne's been in touch saying, hi, Helen, please ask your guest about under-eye treatments. So filler can make them more baggy, tear trough removal, big surgery, tea bags don't work. Any treatment for under-eye bags that she recommends? This is a really, really difficult one for a lot of people, because mm-hmm. you might not be tired, but you can look absolutely exhausted if you mm-hmm. have got bags under your eyes, dark circles. What are some of the things you've got in your toolkit?
So first of all, never use anything out of the kitchen cupboard. I'm like, I cannot say this enough. Please stop using things out of the kitchen cupboard. Please.
What are some of the things you've had clients come and be like,
oh my God. I mean, I've had clients who will be like, oh, you know, doctor, I was out at the beach and then I developed this kind of patch, you know, a little bit of freckling or something. And they said, oh, I just used a lemon. Just cut a lemon in half and used it on my dark spots and, you know, things like that, just to brighten up the area. And I just think, please. Please don't.
Put the vinegar down, put the lemon juice down, put the tea bags down.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
What can we use for under eye bags then?
So, okay, you can use caffeine-based creams. That's going to reduce some of the inflammation and puffiness, which it sounds like they might have that. Also, you know, you have the non-surgical kind of things. So you have the PRP underneath the eyes. You have the skin boosters underneath the eyes. All of this is going to rejuvenate the eye area. You have chemical peels that are specifically for the eye area too. And then you have the surgical options. If there's a lot of puffiness and swelling, it might be that we just need to go in there and remove that fat pad, basically. Okay. Sorry, Helen, but don't underestimate what a good diet. Lower your salt intake, mm-hmm. get your sleep, do not underestimate what these things can do.
Well, I wanted to ask you, because that was always something that my granny told me about eye bags. Like, you know, if you sleep a little bit elevated, if your pillow's a little bit higher, then everything will drain off. And I'm like, oh, that sounds nice, Gran, but, you know, is there any truth in that? But good hydration, good diet, good sleep.
Yes,
get those pillows before you start spending big. Mm-hmm. Okay, right. Text line. Okay. Message anonymous says, re-dodgy treatments, my friend, honest, in brackets, had lip fillers and they've migrated upwards. Should she get them dissolved? How long does it take? They look awful. What does that mean when lip filler migrates, doctor?
So lip filler migration is when the lip filler moves into your kind of your philtrum area where it's the upper lip. The moustache area, basically. It just goes up, floats up into that area. So it makes you look like you've got a moustache. It makes that area very prominent. It just looks very artificial. And you can tell a mile off that this person has had fillers. And, you know, the trend we're seeing now, and I say trend, but this is really the way it should be, is that people are going for very natural, understated, subtle enhancements. So if you've got migration, you don't like it, get it dissolved.
What does that mean? Does that mean you get injected again? So, and where does it go?
Yeah, I mean, so the great thing with filler is that it's a pure hyaluronic acid, okay? It's a gel. And then all we need to do is use a solution called Hyalase, and we inject it exactly where that migration is, where that filler is, and it dissolves instantly on the spot.
There you go. Tell your friend, Anonymous. Dr. Hassia with us today. It is Dr. Hassia on Instagram. If you want to send me the word skin, I'll send you that account so you can have a look. Some of her videos have gone mega viral. Some really great insights on what's happening in the news and, of course, some tips, tricks and hacks as well. We are going to stay with the text line. Debs has been in touch saying our daughter's only 24 but just had Botox, she told us afterwards. She said it's preventative, but I feel like it's a slippery slope. Am I overreacting? If I message about turkey neck, about liquid nose jobs? It's all going on.
This content is for informational purposes only and does not intend to substitute professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Joining us in studio now to talk skin, to talk aesthetics, tweakments, and more is Dr. Hassia. She's here in Dubai at Vawati Clinic. She's the founder and CEO of Doctors Dose. We've been talking Botox, Ozempic face. It's all going on. We had a message here from Deb saying our daughter is only 24 but just had Botox, she told us afterwards. She says it's preventative, but I feel like it's a slippery slope and totally unnecessary. Am I overreacting? We can't say if you're overreacting or not, Dubs, but I guess it comes to that point of why might a 24-year-old want or need Botox, and what's your kind of professional opinion on how you decide who's a good candidate?
I mean, so first of all, where did she have the Botox? Was it masseter because of, you know, teeth grinding at night, or was it preventative? So she mentioned it was preventative, maybe on the forehead, for wrinkles, around the eyes and things. Now, this is something I was discussing before, actually. If you're based in Dubai, you've got fairer skin, maybe you're Caucasian, you've moved from the UK, America, or wherever, you are at a higher risk of aging very fast, okay? Because you have a lower level of melanin in the skin, and melanin actually protects you from some of the UV damage and aging. So therefore, I'm seeing a lot of young people who are Caucasian that have been out in the sun. Maybe they're super active and they're doing all these things, but they're getting wrinkles. They're getting the fine lines around the eyes. They're squinting a lot out in the sun.
So what my dad would say, they look like they've had a hard paper round, even though they haven't actually done, you know, actually, because you just take it a bit harder. Okay, so here's my last question to you, Dr. Hassia. For everyone listening today, what is the one thing we should do, not do, avoid, adjust to keep our skin as healthy and as youthful as possible without looking freaky deaky?
So number one, use SPF. Number two, cover yourself as much as possible. Use big sunglasses. You can use a face visor. You can get that online. It can cover your whole face. Use big hats, that kind of thing. Use an antioxidant in the morning to neutralize the free radicals that you get from sun damage on the skin. Like, you can use vitamin C. So that type of thing, really.
And follow you.
Yes, follow me on Instagram for more.
Thank you so, so much for your time today. If you want Dr. Hassia's details, including where she's practicing and, of course, some of the videos that have gone viral and some great information there, her hot takes on skincare and what's happening in the news, send me the word skin, or it's Dr., the word spelt out, Hassia, on Instagram. See you soon, I hope.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Sure.
It's been really fun, very popular.
This content is for informational purposes only and does not intend to substitute professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
We are so lucky to have some amazing doctors right here in Dubai and also some incredible visiting doctors too. And that's who's in the studio now. We've got oncologist Dr. Sikander joining us from Mayo Clinic. He is based in Jacksonville, Florida, and is an expert in so many different, well, blood cancers. We're talking about the immune system today, about advancements as well. Doctor, thank you. You chose an interesting time to visit the UAE. How are you, sir?
Thanks a lot for having me here. Yes, an interesting time indeed, and I hope everybody is safe and things are recovering, absolutely. But I love coming to Dubai. I have some family here and look forward to this discussion.
Well, thank you for your time. And I'm hoping it's going to be an empowering and positive conversation around what is happening in cancer treatments and advancements, because often when we do talk cancer, we know that numbers are sadly increasing, but it's so encouraging to think that medicine and experts such as yourself are keeping pace. Why did you want to become an oncologist? Did you mind me asking?
I don't really think I have a very clear answer right at the moment, for the simple reason because I'm the only doctor in my family, and I don't know why exactly one fine day I thought, okay, I would follow biology and medicine. But the reason I wanted to become a cancer doctor was purely based on my mentorship and some excellent mentors I worked with. And because the field of cancer, I thought, had so much to offer, so many advancements, that I really thought I could help patients and get to what I know now is a very fulfilling career.
I'm sure that involves some very difficult conversations, but also some really wonderful moments of being able to say, no, there is hope, we can do this. And it sounds like that is certainly something that's changed a lot over the last few years. Can we talk about the body's immune system, its ability to fight cancer? Because patients have gone from having relatively few options to having many more immunotherapies available. Can you tell us a little bit about the past, but more importantly, what's available now?
Absolutely. I think that's an excellent question. So historically, the treatment for cancer was based on drugs that are called conventional chemotherapy or cytotoxic chemotherapy. Basically, in simple words, dumb drugs. They don't know the difference between good and bad. Go in, kill everything, and hopefully the cancer gets controlled. But now the drugs are so targeted, so much smarter, that we have the ability to isolate the DNA of the cancer, find out what might be driving that cancer, and either using a drug that targets that driving force, or in some cases be able to harness the power of the body's own immune system to try and fight against the cancer and specifically target the cancer cells and not have too many damaging effects on the rest of the body.
Are there some cancers where this is perhaps more relevant and more effective?
Yes, by all means. So, for example, lung cancer currently has about 8 or 9 drugs that are approved by the FDA in the US, which are all targeted drugs. So we would isolate the DNA of the cancer, find out which one of those mutations is present, and whichever is present, that specific drug is what the patient gets. And that has been shown to be superior than the conventional chemotherapy.
Can I ask about drug treatments and leading on from that, really? Because it sounds like some becoming so, so effective that some, you know, kind of subset of patients are able to even stop them, you know, stop taking them. Can you tell us a little bit about demographic, you know, age, gender, type of cancer, stage of cancer when it comes to some of these drug treatments, doctor?
Excellent. So, yes, I would say that the treatment for patients with cancer has to be extremely individualized. There cannot be one size fits all. Sometimes, whether it's based on the patient's age, their comorbidities, their stage of the cancer, the type of the cancer, these drugs can be selected. As you rightly mentioned, there are very specific cases where sometimes, even in the setting of either what was considered incurable cancer or metastatic cancer, advanced cancer, the disease is controlled to the point that the patient may be able to stop the treatment eventually. Some of these examples are with metastatic solid organ cancers, where immunotherapy drugs are helping us either, well, one, put the disease in remission, but then may be able to use in a very low dose infrequently, like a maintenance, to keep the disease quiet.
I need to ask you something that feels topical but also kind of personally relevant to me, which is, why do you think people are getting cancer younger? One of my best friends is battling now. We've obviously seen in the headlines around Kate Middleton. There's been all sorts of points around, you know, obesity and lifestyle. But with the information that you have and with conversations with your peers, do you think we are seeing a rise in cancers in younger people, and why might that be?
That is a very important question because that is so relevant. So what you're noticing, what you mentioned about your friend, that is frankly true. We are noticing that the incidence of cancer, the median age of cancer, is slowly shifting towards the younger age. Now, part of that could be just changes in demographics. A lot of multicultural, a lot of influences from a lot of different factors, but certainly lifestyle, environment, movement, exposure to things which are potentially harmful to the body at a younger age and more persistent exposure to those things. Most likely all of this is contributing. Now, we may not have the exact answer for a specific cancer, but all of this seems to be playing the role and bringing, changing the demographics of cancer.
With that in mind, and I ask you this as an oncologist and a father, is there anything that you would never allow your daughters to do, to try, to eat, in order to safeguard them as far as possible against certain types of cancer?
I think you're, again, an extremely important question. I mean, my wife think, who both of us are doctors, we think about this constantly. What is it that we should or shouldn't do with our kids to safeguard their future? I give a similar advice to all my patients, just leading a healthy, balanced life with regular exercise, a balanced diet, trying to limit too much of processed foods. And even if somebody wants to take vitamins, minerals, et cetera, try to take as much derived from the regular diet rather than supplements. I think all of that is immensely important.
Joining us this afternoon, so delighted to welcome not just the studio, but to the UAE. We've got Dr. Sikander speaking to us. He is from Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville, Florida. He is still waiting for his bags from Jacksonville, Florida, and is here in the UAE, expert oncologist. We're going to talk next about some of the advancements in diagnostics, which I think is really, really important, and even around supportive care, as we talk about managing pain, nausea. How has that changed in recent years?
This content is for informational purposes only and does not intend to substitute professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Joining us in studio now, we have got expert oncologist Dr. Sikander of the Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville, Florida. He's here in the UAE for just a few days, and we're talking now about how cancer treatment is advancing, what that means for people living with cancer. And I guess before we even get to that point, Doctor, what about the diagnostic piece? Because, you know, I say it every time we talk about cancer on the show of various kinds, you know, early prevention saves lives. And yes, there's a role and responsibility of us as the people to be, you know, aware and body aware and educated and taking ourselves to clinic. But once we get there, what are some of the advancements that you've seen in your career as an oncologist that can really speed up the diagnostic process?
That's an excellent question. So we are noticing a lot of newer techniques that are now available, whether it's advanced imaging, advanced diagnostics based on lab tests. So, for example, now small numbers of cancer cells that are circulating in the blood can be picked up by simple blood tests. I understand that that may not be the best way to diagnose cancer in the beginning, but for patients who have had cancer controlled and are concerned about, let's say, metastatic disease, mm-hmm. well, that becomes an excellent opportunity to find cancer fast so that it can be treated early.
Do you think in, you know, 5-10 years' time we'll be having conversations about, I don't know, like the Jetsons, you know, you step into a booth and they go do 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 do, and there's a little lovely laser scan and it goes, we're detecting a potential problem in the liver area. You know, how far away do we think are from really widespread mainstream detection like that?
So we might be still a little farther away from Jetsons or the beep noise, but some tests are being developed right now and being validated where a simple blood test from a patient could help screen for a series of large number of cancers. Now, I should say that those tests are not yet mainstream because the benefit of testing with those tests has not yet been proven on a population-wide basis. Mm-hmm. But I can imagine that those kind of tests could be easily applied into some high-risk situations, some families where cancer is running, or some populations where cancer is more prevalent.
Let's talk about supportive care. You have had that diagnosis. You're going through treatment. This is such a hard part of the battle, you know, the nausea, the pain, wanting to enjoy, you know, if you have had a terminal diagnosis, wanting to enjoy time with your family for as long as possible and have that quality of life. What are we seeing there? Well, everything, I guess, from physical support, but also the psychological side as well.
Very, very, very important. So as a cancer-treating physician, a doctor, while I have time to talk to the patient about the cancer itself, the treatment, the immunotherapy, the chemotherapy, the diagnostics, the remission, etc., very frequently we may not have time in that core appointment to talk about all those things that you just mentioned. Mm-hmm. Emotional support, psychological support, financial issues, caregiver issues, etc. So it literally takes a village to treat a patient. So in an institution like Mayo Clinic, for example, when a patient comes to us, we do recruit a lot of these resources. We have certain screens which every cancer patient goes through to look for any psychological stress. If there is psychological stress noted, well, then that triggers a social work consult or a psychology psychiatry consult. The role of cardio-oncology because of so looking at the heart impacts from drugs, a neurologist, palliative care. Mm-hmm. If I am controlling symptoms with drugs that I have available, but the patient is still noticing a lot of those symptoms, whether it is nausea, it is pain, it's neuropathy, it's fear, it's anxiety, etc. Well, palliative care comes, and their goal is to help control symptoms. I should say a lot of times palliative care and hospice are confused with each other. Palliative care is symptom control. Hospice might be end-of-life care.
Lastly, and we touched on it earlier in terms of what you're, you know, encouraging your daughters to do and not do, which it's always, I always find it really frustrating because it's always the boring stuff. You know, it's the healthy exercise, don't smoke, you know, watch your alcohol intake, et cetera, et cetera. It's never like, I would never let my daughters drink out of a plastic cup, which would be really nice and easy. But to everyone listening today, and I know we can bang the drum about early detection is key. What else do you think we need to know about the diagnosis and, of course, managing perhaps that around friends and family around cancer? What haven't we touched on, Doctor?
Yeah, I think it's important to keep in mind that while cancer is a very personal topic for everybody, mm-hmm. it's probably important as for a cancer patient to be able to share that information with their friends and family, especially their family, their immediate family. Because we know that the incidence of cancer in some cases may be higher in immediate family members. So there are some guidelines around where a family member of a cancer patient may need to start screening tests earlier in their life. So let's say if colon cancer screening is starting at 40 or 50, well, in certain cases, it might have to start at 35. So that kind of discussion and open dialogue is extremely important.
And then allow good people like yourself to do what you're good at. Dr. Sikander, thank you so, so much. For anyone who wants to find you on social and, of course, when you're back in Florida, what's the best way of finding you? I know you share a lot of content on social.
Yes. So for me, I work at Mayo Clinic. I think all of Mayo Clinic contacts would be the best way to. And we are on mayoclinic.org. And of course, through that, a whole gamut of our social media handles.
Thank you so much. Great to have you in the UAE. Really, really a pleasure to chat. And as I said, an empowering conversation, an important one, and one that I hope gives hope to people out there today. If you want those doctor's details, you can send me the word doc, no questions asked, on 4001.
This content is for informational purposes only and does not intend to substitute professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
And thank you for downloading this episode of the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. Don't forget, you can subscribe. You'll get direct to your phone as soon as it's out. And you can listen to me live on Dubai Eye 103.8, Monday to Friday between 2 and 5 p.m.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.